Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the BlackRock Global Allocation Fund conference call. My name is Corey, and I will be your event coordinator for today. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. If at any time you require operator assistance, you can press star followed by zero on the telephone to assist you. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host for today, Mr. David Dendy. You may now proceed, David.
Thanks, Corey, and good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for joining today's teleconference, where we will provide you with an update on the BlackRock Global Allocation Fund. My name is David Dendy, the Retail National Sales Manager, and I'm your host today. We trust you all have the presentation that was emailed through on Tuesday. Today's agenda is short and simple. I'll start with a few comments on why BlackRock sees international markets as offering some great investment opportunities. I'll then hand over to Vincent Loblanco, Investment Specialist for the Global Allocation Fund, who will present on the highlights of the Global Allocation Fund's investment philosophy and approach, discuss in detail the fund's positioning and performance, then provide some reasoning as to the benefits the fund can deliver to your international allocation. We will then open the call to questions. So to begin with, if I can start with slide two, just looking at the case for international equities. Turning over to slide three, we can see here the well-documented re-emergence of the Asian and in particular emerging markets as a percentage of world GDP. Since the 1950s, we can see a continual increase as to the Asian increases GDP as a portion of world contribution. And with that, it does present many investment opportunities. However, in order to take advantage of those opportunities, a flexible investment approach is what is required. Slide four just looks at the breakdown of the developed versus emerging markets in a little bit more detail. The highly indebted industrialised countries in the green there, looking in particular Northern America, Western Europe and Japan, versus the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China. And it's the emphasis there on those orange countries that are experiencing significant population growth, increasing demand for materials due to consumption growth, and overall economic growth. And it's these countries that are likely to be the key drivers of the global economy over the medium to long term. In addition, the debt that is experienced by these developed economies are likely to hinder a lot of economic growth and also diminish some of the investment opportunities that do exist. Looking at a bit more detail there on slide five as to the breakdown of these emerging versus developed economies. On the left-hand side there, the blue bars, you can see we're looking at savings rate as a percentage of disposable income, and on the right-hand side, looking at consumer debt as a percentage of GDP. And some observations from here is that the emerging markets have a higher savings rate, and therefore that is money that can be transferred into consumption. Emerging markets also do have lower levels of debt, so consequently those countries or members of the community there have a higher level of disposable income or have the capacity to increase debt to spend. It's well documented the lower wages that do exist in emerging markets. However, the key to this is the significant population that delivers scale. And when you look at China and India with a population of some two plus billion people, a third of the world's population, it's that scale that does represent the investment opportunities. And again, in addition to this, the developed markets with their lower level of disposable income and higher level of debt can also hinder some of the economic growth and investment opportunities. Looking to slide six, we're just really articulating here on the left-hand side, we're looking at the trade balance of, on this chart here, Germany, Greece, Spain and Portugal. And whilst the European Union and the broader European area is highly indebted and some parts potentially in recession, there are still some investment opportunities that do exist, and Germany is a very good illustration of this, as you can see in the blue. So we're benefiting greatly from this emerging markets resurgence, China in particular, where they're exporting a great number of their goods and services to there. And again, this is all supported by a low euro strengthening their position within the European Union. And what it does highlight again is just the need for a flexible investment approach that can allow investment managers to take advantage of these investment opportunities. Slide 7 just looks at the composition of the ASX 200 versus the MSCI. And you can see they're looking at the sector breakdown on the left-hand side, the ASX 200, and in the two bold numbers there at the bottom, financials and materials, representing 38 and 28% of the market composition, respectively. So Australia in the last number of years, 15 plus years, has performed very well, and we've benefited because of this China growth, and our materials and related areas have done particularly well, and the growth of the economy domestically has meant financials and banks have done particularly well. However, with the emergence of Asia and the population and demographic changes that are occurring there, sectors such as IT, consumer discretionary and health, at the top of the chart there, will be sectors that will particularly benefit from these type of emerging themes. They are sectors, however, that are underrepresented within the ASX 200, and in fact, when you look at the MSCI weight, 12% for IT, 10% for consumer discretionary and 9% for health. Essentially, it will just reflect that we need to be thinking beyond just our Australian shores to look for exposure to sectors that can take advantage of these emerging investment opportunities. Slide 8 just looks at the PE forward-looking ratios, and historically global equities have traded at a premium and have been more expensive, and as can be seen by that red line there, PE ratios have come down closer towards Australia, and consequently that means that global equities are looking cheap on a PE basis. Overlay that with slide 9, which reflects our Australian terms of trade, indicative of the high Aussie dollar, supported also by interest rate differentials from Australian versus US, Europe, UK, both very strong contributors towards the high levels of the Aussie dollar versus the US, the Europe and UK. And in particular, what that means is that for Aussie dollar investors, the world is on sale, and these investment opportunities are offering up at good purchasing prices. And then just lastly, again, another illustration that even within these developed economies, investment opportunities do still exist. US corporates have got the highest cash balances since the 50s. Technology companies, pharmaceutical, consumer product companies all have billions of dollars sitting on cash in their balance sheet. Cisco, Microsoft, Google, Oracle, you can see there at the bottom of the chart, have got much weighted cash in their balance sheet. They can do a few things with this cash. They can pay out cash returns to shareholders, or they can reinvest in their business for future growth. And in fact, many of these US conglomerates are actually investing in and taking advantage of selling their widgets and wares into countries like Asia and emerging markets. So in summary, in our view, international markets do represent some terrific investment opportunities. Emerging markets are providing some of those better investment opportunities. Markets are cheap on a PE basis, and the Aussie dollar is strong. You do, however, need a flexible investment approach to take advantage of these opportunities. So I'll now hand over to Vincent LeBlanco, Investment Specialist for the Global Allocation Fund, who will take you through the key elements of the Global Allocation Fund, our view on international markets and how we're positioned as a result, and then share with you our investment performance. And I hand over to you, sir.
Thanks very much, David, and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you very much for taking the time out today to listen to this update on the BlackRock Global Allocation Fund. If you'd like to turn over to slide 12, just four dot points of highlights for the fund that I'd like to re-emphasise for you. Clearly, we believe that this is one of the world's leading and most experienced and successful investment teams. We've been managing this strategy globally since February 89, and specifically in Australia since we launched our fund in July 2005. We have a proven long-term philosophy and process that has delivered superior and consistent long-term performance returns. Remembering that one of the aims of this fund is to reward clients on the upside when equity markets are rallying, and have, through our flexibility and our diversification, the ability to protect clients' capital on the downside. And we believe that this fund deserves to be a core part of your clients' global exposures. Slide 13, there's a detailed slide there on the investment philosophy. Many of you will be familiar with this, but the goal of this fund is to deliver competitive returns with low to moderate levels of risk. And we believe that you can achieve that by being broadly diversified across asset classes, across countries, sectors, and market capitalizations. We do have, as I said before, a very experienced investment team. And, you know, when you think about the inefficiencies in global markets and the ability to be able to find value wherever you go, it's important that we think that in the global investing environment of today, we're very specialised. People look at particular boxes of different regions or different market caps and to a degree different asset classes, whereby we think that when you look at the opportunity set, a lot of these things and interactions between these asset classes are largely ignored in the specialist world, and we think that this fund is able to bridge those gaps. And, you know, to reconfirm, we do look at a total return on our investments. We take very much what is the best total return outlook on our investments on a 3 to 5 year view. So if you turn over to 14, and just before I get into the current positioning, I'd like to just briefly share with you, clearly in investing at the present time, there are some pretty large macro situations to, I guess, take account of at the present time. And I want to share with you what our views are at present. And clearly the global economy faces many near-term challenges. In addition to concerns about the financial state of the peripheral nations in Europe, which is getting the day-to-day headlines in the newspapers and on TV, the US economic recovery still remains fragile, with only about 2-3% GDP growth. And in the last month or so, there have been renewed concerns that China is in the midst of a soft patch in economic performance that could adversely affect overall global growth. And if that's not enough, in addition to all of this, we are facing, as you've seen recently, a presidential election in France. We have elections in Greece, in the US, and that's coupled with a once-in-a-decade leadership change in China. And all of these things have the potential to deliver periodic bounce of instability into global markets. While each of these events is important in its own right, monetary policies in the developed world remain very loose, with interest rates at historically low levels and central banks debating the potential for more quantitative easing. In the emerging economies, while outright quantitative easing is not being pursued, interest rates and bank reserve requirements are being steadily reduced. And indeed, if you take an example of Australia, an economy that is highly leveraged into emerging market growth, the Reserve Bank is clearly on an easing path going forward. The combined goals of these monetary policies is to either stimulate growth and or reduce the real interest rate earned in cash and government bonds. As a result, investors are having to rethink the cost of cash and find other investments that may introduce more portfolio volatility, but that offer a better chance of growing purchasing power over the long-term time horizon. We believe investors have a far better ability to observe price than to predict the future. In that respect, while equity prices are no longer at the bargain levels that were witnessed in September and October of last year, we still believe price remains much more in favour of the equity investor than the fixed income investor. Accordingly, we have chosen to maintain an overweight to global equities in the portfolio. And as many of you have followed this portfolio over the years, at almost 65% equity exposure, that is amongst the highest percentage exposures to equities that we've had in the 23 years of running this strategy. Our positioning in fixed income and cash, while not areas of the portfolio where we forecast the most attractive long-term returns, will nevertheless remain an integral part of the portfolio as we seek to mitigate volatility, particularly over this current market cycle. So if we look at the equity component of the portfolio, which is about 64.5%, you can see on that pie chart the breakup in terms of exposure to the domicile or where those companies are listed. And I'd like to go over just the major reasons and what our logic is for having the sorts of exposures that we have. In blue on the left-hand side of each of our exposures, I've also included there the traditional weight that you would find for those regions in a traditional MSCI benchmarked equity fund. So if I take the US for a moment, those of you, again, who have followed this fund over the years will know that North America, and predominantly the US, was in around 2006, going in 2007 as low as 45% of our equity weighting. We have, over the last few years, built that up to now almost 60% of our equity weighting. And so if I can focus on the US for a moment, clearly the US economy delivered positive economic surprises over the first quarter of this year, including a further decline in the unemployment rate. Now, interestingly, analysts' US earnings estimates had been trending steadily downward for months before a modest reversal in late March. Currently, estimates for this year's first quarter imply year-over-year growth of around 2%, and essentially no growth from actual earnings that were produced in last year's fourth quarter. At this point, expectations for first quarter results have been set so low that companies may be able to beat such a drastically lowered hurdle. By the end of March, 82% of S&P 500 companies that reported results beat estimates by an average of 8.5%. Now, while low expectations may optically result in a positive earnings season, the real challenge may come in the second quarter and predominantly the second half of this year, where bottom-up estimates still show 8.4% growth in earnings for 2012. While corporate earnings will be the focus of investor attention over the near term, we believe corporate earnings are likely to post positive, albeit slower growth, rather than experience an outright decline. More importantly, valuations remain reasonable and corporations continue to show an increased willingness to return cash to shareholders via both share buybacks and dividends. Interestingly, the announcement by Apple in the first quarter of this year to pay its first dividend since 1995 is further evidence of this trend, with payout rates historically still below their long-term averages. The potential for further increases in dividends makes US equities an appealing investment for investors who can absorb volatility and are looking for a superior alternative to low-yielding fixed income investments. When we look at the other three key regions, firstly, and David mentioned the emerging markets, the emerging market equities have got off to a very strong start in 2012 so far, as renewed risk appetite among global investors caused the MSCI Emerging Market Index to rally 14% in the first quarter. Despite profit-taking in selected names in the portfolio, we remain overweight Asia and Latin America, given the attractive valuation profile that many of the countries in these regions possess relative to the developed world. While economic growth rates in the emerging economies have slowed modestly, they are coming off a very high base and are still very attractive in absolute terms when compared to the developed world. In addition, monetary policy has become more accommodative in many emerging economies over the past few quarters. Many of you will remember that a number of emerging economies were tightening policy with inflation fears through the early to middle parts of 2011. And for us, the lagged impact of those decisions could prove positive to economic growth and corporate earnings as this year progresses. In Europe, although economic growth is likely to remain weak, both in absolute and relative terms to the rest of the world, the European Central Bank's long-term refinancing operation have materially reduced, in our view, the possibility of a banking collapse that had unnerved investors for much of 2011 and particularly in the third quarter. Notwithstanding the economic effects of further austerity measures in the peripheral economies, equity valuations across the region are at a steep discount to the global average, and in our view, present opportunities for long-term value investors. As an example, recently, German car makers have reported record sales in China as stronger wage growth in the emerging world leads to a rise in luxury car demand. This anecdotal evidence is a reminder that there is a difference between European economies and European companies. We remain underweight European equities at about 10% of the total portfolio, but remain vigilant for investment opportunities in companies with single-digit price multiples, above average dividend yields, and exposure to emerging market consumer trends. We continue, and those of you who have been following this portfolio for a while will know that we have been, in a relative sense, overweight Japanese equities for a while. Now, whilst we remain overweight Japan, we used the first quarter rally in Japanese stocks to pare back on positions in both export and domestic-oriented industries. On February the 14th, the Bank of Japan announced that it was raising its inflation goal to a meager 1% and increasing its asset purchase program by 10 trillion yen to 65 trillion. These policy changes weakened the yen, which had a subsequently strong positive impact on sentiment for Japanese export stocks and the Japanese equity market in general. From a macro perspective, we continue to view Japan as an attractive market for investment. Japanese GDP is forecast to grow at around 1.5% in 2012 after a decline of 0.75% in 2011. Growth should be stimulated by a 12 trillion yen supplemental budget for earthquake rebuilding. And remember, the size of the Japanese economy is around 500 trillion, so it's a significant stimulus to the economy, along with increases in production as industries recover from the earthquake and from the flooding in Thailand after that. Japanese equity valuations are among the cheapest in the world. On a current year PE basis, Japan now sells at multiples compared to many other developed markets, which is different to where it has been for many years. If you could turn over to slide 15, I guess in many respects it is the fixed income world that has received most of the attention of markets during the GFC and subsequent to the GFC. So really it is in this part of the portfolio that has changed more significantly over the past couple of years. The first point to note is that we remain underweight US Treasuries. Now, if you think of a neutral benchmark that we might take in a normal world, we would probably have around 16% of the portfolio in US Treasuries. We've currently got around 7. And we have been reducing our position in US Treasuries through the first quarter as we sort out various areas of the corporate and non-US sovereign bond markets that could provide us with a more attractive risk-return profile. Recognising that interest rates across the US Treasury curve are typically below the current rate of US headline inflation and thus provide very little purchasing power protection if held to maturity, US Treasuries continue to perform an important role in portfolio diversification. More specifically, in a world of rising correlations across asset classes, the ability of US Treasuries to provide negative correlation to global equities is an important characteristic that allows the overall fund to deliver a more moderate level of risk. While the year is still in its early stages, investors have begun to discuss the potential fiscal cliff facing the US economy at the beginning of 2013. It is estimated that the expiration of the Bush tax cuts, the payroll tax cut, and the implementation of the $1 trillion sequester on the back of the increasing the debt ceiling could provide anywhere between a 2.5% to 3% headwind to growth for the US economy. Whether politicians will allow these policies to impact the US economy all at once remains to be seen, but any actions taken will need to be coordinated across parties and take place shortly after an election that could bring with it a change in the White House. Previous episodes of necessary collaboration, most recently in the third quarter of 2011, do not leave much room for hope. Should the US government extend tax cuts in order to keep the company growing without simultaneous actions to reduce long-term fiscal deficits, it is unclear how the US Treasury market will react. Even though the US does not possess the least attractive government debt to GDP ratio in the developed world, it is among the most reliant on foreigners to refinance its sovereign debt. While it is difficult to know exactly when these foreign investors will become disenchanted with the current state of the US government's finances, we must not assume that their complicity will continue indefinitely. We continue to hold around 2 to 3% of the portfolio in a diversified basket of US corporate and convertible bond securities. We have continued to reduce exposure in convertible bonds. Many of you will remember that we took a significant position in convertible bonds, which in this pie chart are the green hybrid securities, on the back of the strong performance in those convertible bonds since the recovery in equity markets. And we've used that money to selectively add to investment-grade corporates with 3 to 5 year maturities as an alternate to US Treasuries, because we believe they provide a more attractive risk-return trade-off and allow us to take advantage of the financial strength of corporate balance sheets that David had referred to earlier. We remain cautious, however, on US corporate high-yield debt, as we believe much of the return in this market has been driven by a desire for yield in a low interest rate environment. Additionally, we're cognizant that this asset class possesses a high degree of correlation to our overweight in equities, which reduces the diversification benefits of holding fixed income in the portfolio. In terms of the non-US fixed income, we own about 14% of the portfolio in non-US fixed income. We've modestly trimmed the exposure in emerging market sovereign debt, but continue to find select opportunities in Brazil due to the high real interest rates and the central bank that has been cutting interest rates and may continue to do so in an effort to spur economic growth. We've also maintained similar positions in Malaysia, Hong Kong, Singapore, Mexico, and indeed Australia. While inflation remains a risk to various emerging market fixed income investments, our strategy has been to keep our duration short as we anticipate rising currency values will more than compensate for a potential inflation risk. In non-US credit, the portfolio maintains modest overweights to corporate and convertible bonds in emerging Asia, Latin America, and Eastern Europe, and took advantage of select opportunities to increase this exposure over the course of the first quarter. As I said earlier, the European Central Bank's provisions have vastly reduced, in our view, the probability of any failures in the European banking sector and helped to provide some stability in many European bond markets. Nevertheless, we continue to avoid sovereign bonds in peripheral Europe due to the possibility of future debt restructurings and the inability for austerity measures alone to stabilise debt to GDP ratios. We hold a modest overweight position in intermediate term German bonds while we continue to avoid Italian, French, Belgian, Greek, Portuguese and Spanish sovereigns. We continue to overweight UK gilts, and as you're aware, UK has been able to take a significant devaluation of their currency, implement austerity measures. But we've started to trim some of that overweight in UK gilts as we believe the end of the most recent round of quantitative easing that has been announced, coupled with a more challenging fiscal environment, could cause prices to come under pressure. In Canada, we retain a modest position in intermediate term sovereign debt, given the more attractive yield characteristics that the Canadian bond market offers relative to US Treasuries. And the final point of this chart is clearly the cash position, which in terms of its exposure to the overall portfolio sits at around 12%. Now, we increased that cash weighting over the first quarter of 2012 as a result of our profit taking in equities and in convertible bonds and in some areas of the government bond market. With interest rates at historical lows across various regions, cash continues to function as a zero duration fixed income component of the portfolio and is there as a source of funds in the event of further equity market volatility. And if you remember, in September 2008, we had a total cash exposure of the total portfolio of around 20%. And we were able to use that cash at that point in time to gain initially our foothold into corporate bonds and to take advantage of an improving equity environment. If you'd like to turn over to slide 16, there clearly is the summary of our exposures in terms of asset allocation. But what I'd like to do, I've just got a few minutes left, what I'd like to do is to just select a couple of the key sectors that we see globally, just two of the key sectors where we're overweight and two of the key sectors where, relative to a more traditional equity portfolio, where we're underweight. And firstly, the first of our overweights is materials. And, you will be aware that we have been overweight materials for a reasonable period of time. Now, our total exposure to materials in terms of the overall portfolio, we've got about an 8% exposure to materials-based equities. But about half of our sector weighting in materials continues to be represented by gold ETFs and gold mining equities. The gold price has experienced some volatility over the last two quarters, with five swings of around 10% since peaking at $1,900 an ounce at the end of September 2011. Gold has been a long-term position in our portfolio, and we believe it continues to play a valuable role in portfolio construction. We believe that loose developed market monetary policies and ongoing European sovereign debt issues will direct investors to seek gold as a store of economic value. The recent trend of central banks buying gold for diversification purposes should also continue through time, particularly if the Federal Reserve has to resort to another round of quantitative easing. In addition to precious metals, we also have a preference for input sectors of the global economy, including exposure to specialty chemicals and base metals. In certain areas of the base metal space, We reduced exposure in the first quarter of 2012 after observing some seasonal weakness in demand out of China, and we'll be re-evaluating more attractive entry points over the course of this year. The other sector of significant overweight is energy, and that too has about an 8% exposure of the total portfolio. This sector remains a long-term structural theme in the portfolio, predicated on the belief that oil prices are likely to rise at rates that exceed broader inflation levels due to increasing services and materials pricing. Within the sector, we express our long-term energy views on oil through the global integrated companies that offer attractive multiples and favourable dividend yields. We also favour mid and large cap exploration and production firms and coal equities due to the fact that coal prices currently trade at the short-term marginal cost of supply, creating in our view a floor whereby producers will shut mines to support prices in this environment. While natural gas producers do not represent a significant portion of our sector weighting, we have maintained positions with certain producers trading at inexpensive valuations that have the scale and balance sheet to weather the storm and therefore provide valuable optionality to a long-term, five-plus year bull case on natural gas based on fuel substitution both in transport and utilities. And the two key underweights are financials. About 9% of our overall portfolio is exposed to financial equities. And in a traditional MSCI portfolio, it's probably more like 18%. Now, we remain underweight developed market financial stocks due largely to extraordinarily low interest rates, which continue to depress earnings and the continuation of the deleveraging process occurring in many developed markets, which is likely to limit the growth potential for financial firms. In addition, we have become more cautious on financials in the emerging markets, given the recent moderation in economic growth and the impact of wage inflation, which we believe may negatively impact earnings growth. From an industry point of view, we favour the diversified financial services and capital markets companies, given attractive valuations, and the property and casualty insurers on a firming of the pricing environment for those sectors. We are less favourable on listed property trusts due to valuation and life insurers due to the prolonged low rate environment. We continue to underweight commercial banks given the low interest rate environment and the slow economic recovery translating into lower loan growth. The other area of underweight is clearly, and we have been for probably since around 2006, are consumer staples. This sector's rich valuation relative to the market as a defensive sector has made it especially vulnerable to negative incremental news flows out of Europe and a slowing of economic data in the US. Our largest holdings continue to reflect a bias towards US and European listed companies with significant exposure to emerging markets, strong balance sheets, and or unique upside catalysts over the next 12 months. In a few instances, the above average dividend yields we can obtain from these companies, coupled with attractive valuation, has caused us to recently add some names that can serve as a better usage of capital than we can obtain in the fixed income markets. And finally, I just want to mention currencies, and I've had a number of queries from investors in the fund on our currency exposure. And again, many of you remember we were significantly underweight our exposure to the US dollar at the beginning of the GFC. We have, over recent periods, increased our weighting to the US dollar, where now we are marginally overweight in a neutral sense from from our internal reference benchmark. Now, the increase in the US dollar weighting has been put in place partially as a result of hedging a portion of the portfolio's yen and euro exposures back to US dollars. We believe the ongoing debt crisis in Europe and the possibility of future monetary stimulus from the European Central Bank could cause the euro to weaken versus the US dollar. Accordingly, we remain significantly underweight the euro. And as well, with respect to the yen, our decision to hedge part of our currency exposure was based on our view that the currency was at very expensive levels relative to the US dollar, and thus we have sought ways to insulate the portfolio from a possible depreciation in the yen. The Bank of Japan's announcement in February to target 1% inflation level to increase their asset purchases was ultimately the catalyst for the subsequent depreciation in the yen, which caused these hedges to work quite favourably in the quarter. Longer term, as many of you are aware, we continue to favour a number of currencies of countries in Asia, led by China, but including Taiwan, South Korea, Hong Kong and Singapore, these countries that have built up formidable FX reserves. And they have the firepower, should they choose, to draw on these reserves to mitigate any sharp declines in the value of their currencies, if you remember, as they did in the late 90s. And the last point I'd make is that I said earlier, we still have a reasonable exposure to gold and gold-related mining companies. And you know, this allocation continues to represent our view that aggressive monetary policies from the world's developed market economies may continue into the near future and cause investors to seek out alternate asset classes as a store of economic value. With inflation rates exceeding short-term deposit rates across multiple regions around the world, it is our belief that gold remains in demand as investors fear the future purchasing power losses of paper currencies. So there's a lot of information there. Hopefully you've got some from it. I'd like to finish with just a summary of performance, if you could turn to slide 17. I said earlier in my introduction that the goal of this fund is to seek to offer competitive returns at lower than equity market risk. And what this chart shows is, if you like, the NAV in the dark blue line of our fund in Australia, net of fees. And so clearly it shows that we have, from July 5 to today, outperformed and given very competitive returns versus hedged global equities, and we've done it clearly on a lower risk profile. And I think one of the key points of this chart is that, you know, at the peak of our fund in terms of the high water mark was around May 08, and we were able to return the value of our clients' investment back to that high point just on 2 years, or just inside of 2 years from that point in time. And as David said earlier, people's frustration with global equities can be, I guess, seen on this in the sense that it's been 4.5 years and counting for global investors to get back to that October 07 high point. And, you know, the MSCI hedge still has almost 9% return to go from the end of March to get to that level, whereas clearly we've added 16.5% on top of that high water mark. I'm on the next page on 18. It's a bit of a busy chart, but I think it's important when we look at your client's overall exposure and why this fund is important. And what I've tried to do on this chart is to look at various phases since July 5 when we implemented the fund, and if we take July 5 to October 07 as the bull market, then the bear market arguably finishing in Feb 09, and then the recovery through to March. If we take the July 05, October 07 bull market, the coloured bars working from the left are simply the Global Allocation Fund gross, the dark blue is net of fees, the orange is that internal neutral what the internal neutral benchmark return would be. The green is the MSCI hedged. The yellow is the Australian share market. The maroon is the global fixed income hedged. The lighter green is the Australian fixed income market, Australian bond, composite all maturities market, and the olive green is the bank bill index. And I think there's a couple of points. You know, I said earlier, an aim is to try and reward on the upside, maintain participation in markets when equities are rallying. And we can see in that bull market that, you know, in net terms, we outperform global equities through that period, but we very much underperformed Australian equities during that time. And I remember many clients asking the question, I think David alluded to it earlier, why are we in global equities when Australia is doing so well? And I think David very clearly enunciated that was a period of strong performance in materials and commodities. It was a period of strong global growth. It was a period of strong bank and financial markets returns. And clearly, the Australian share market outperformed most share markets in the world through that period. If I look at the bear market period, then, you know, what is important, as I said, we want to participate on the upside to protect clients' capital as best we can in the downside in a diversified way. You know, our drawdown and capital loss in that period was about half of what global equities and Australian equities drew down during that period. So we were able to keep pace with equities in the bear market, lose about half through the GFC, which was a pretty significant stress test on any portfolio. In the subsequent recovery, I think what is very interesting to note is, A, we've kept pace again, broadly, with global equities, but you can see the MSCI has probably been the best performing asset class through the recovery, and I think a lot of that reflects the issues that David was talking about in terms of those industries globally that have performed very well, and with a focus more away, perhaps, particularly of financials in those areas that were most stretched within the Australian economy. And clearly, our market has been hurt somewhat by the higher Australian dollar on some of our sectors. So, you know, for those clients who were saying, well, you know, I should only be in the Australian market, I think if you look at the recovery through that period, the Australian market has lagged significantly, and I think you know many of those reasons. So importantly, look at the combined period, and if you look at that combined period, our portfolio has pretty much done as well as hedge global bonds, which has been the stellar performer through a global financial crisis. That defensive asset class has done best, but we've certainly beaten the equity areas, and we've done just about as well as any asset class has done. And I think, you know, and certainly outperformed equities through that combined period. So, you know, I think our portfolio has delivered on many of its aims. The next page on, the next slide on 19 simply shows that as an individual asset class performance. Yes, I will acknowledge that, you know, on a risk return basis, net of fees, we are a riskier fund than a pure bond fund, you know, a pure 100% defensive fund. But clearly, we've shown less risk than particularly Aussie equities or hedged global equities, but clearly demonstrated that we've beaten pretty much every asset class through that period. So as a core exposure for your clients' global exposures, you know, the fund has delivered, I think, through that period. Enough of the necessarily the hard sell from me, because I do want to leave some time to answer questions, but for your benefit on slide 20 are the raw numbers, and I think, you know, the one point I would make for your clients when you sit down with them and look at their portfolio, this portfolio has delivered 7.8% net of fees per annum since July 05. And I think that stacks up very well against many portfolios, I would suggest. The second point is on page 21. When you look at the return versus volatility, you know, over 3 and 5 years, the fund is competitive with equities with lower volatility, and that gets right back to the original total return, competitive returns with lower volatility than equities. So in summary on 22, and then I'll be happy to open up the questions, you know, This team has been stress tested a lot since February 89. And, you know, the team is very highly rated and acknowledged globally. I think our philosophy has stood the test of time and process has stood the test of time. The team has delivered those long-term performance numbers. We have delivered an innovative pricing structure, which many of you will know, but be happy to take questions on that should you wish to. We do believe that this should be used as a core part for your clients' global exposure. And remember, you know, things may look a little rosy, perhaps, and certainly over the first quarter of this year as far as risk asset goes, but, you know, we have structured the portfolio in such a way that we still have good protection should, should the opportunity, you know, emerge that we don't get through these uncertainties in the world at the present time and that we do get another downdraft in equities. Page 23 is an example, I think, a statement of those good ratings that the portfolio has. And then, of course, the all-important disclaimer on 24. Thanks for your time. I hope I have given you a good feel for the way our outlook and the way the portfolio is positioned. But I'll pass back to David. Thank you.
Thanks, Vincent. We'll now hand over to Corey, who will open the call up for any questions.
Thank you very much, David. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, you can press star followed by one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered or you would like to withdraw that question, you can press star followed by two on your touchtone telephone. Questions will be taken in order received. Please press star one to begin. And David, I have no questions currently in the queue.
Okay, well, we'll take silence as positive. Thanks, Corey. So we will finish things up then. We'd like to thank all of you who took the time to dial in today. We know you are busy, so we're grateful for your attendance. We trust the session provided you with the detail you needed on, as a reminder of the fund's process and philosophy, some of the performance detail and insight, and why we see the Global Allocation Fund as a key part of your client's international exposure. If you do have any further queries, please do not hesitate to contact your account manager. We will also forward through a recording of today's call, should you wish to run through some of the issues again. Thank you and have a good day.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's presentation. You may now disconnect. Thank you and have a great remainder of your day.